hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's been another busy week of breaking news on COVID-19. I was joined by Dr. Harvey Risch, a senior epidemiologist and professor of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine, with Laura Ingram on the Ingram Angle. Let's listen.
The well-funded campaign to vaccinate every living American could be putting lives at risk. Two doctors are here to explain what they found in three new studies. Democrats love to talk about the right to privacy. Well, that's now an obstacle to their goal, though, of forcing COVID vaccines on every American. Now, case in point, California Governor Gavin Newsom is sending out roughly 2,000 door knockers to show up at citizens' homes to inquire about their vaccination status. And the media, well, they're joining in. This is from USA Today. Fact check: businesses can legally ask if patrons have been vaccinated. HIPAA does not apply. Of course, the prospect, though, of widespread vaccine shaming has Dr. Fauci and friends very excited.
There's no doubt in my mind, or in many of my public health colleagues, that we're already starting to see steps in that direction, where independent entities will likely be requiring proof of vaccination before you can either get on a plane or step into a university campus.
Well, why stop at vaccines? But speaking of this, could they actually be endangering your health? Here now is Dr. Harvey Risch, professor at the Yale School of Public Health, and Dr. Peter McCullough, cardiologist, internist, and epidemiologist. Dr. McCullough, quickly summarize these three new papers that have you worried about this.
Well, thanks for having me on, Laura. It's important that we've made great progress in COVID-19. Patients are being treated early. Rates of hospitalizations and deaths are way down. But a common question I get in clinical practice is, do I need the COVID-19 vaccine if I've already had COVID-19? And very importantly, is there any risk to that? Well, the randomized trials, the registrational trials, excluded patients with prior COVID-19, so we had no safety data, and to this day, we have no studies demonstrating any clinical benefit. Now, two studies out of the United Kingdom and one out of New York City show higher rates of vaccine adverse events when COVID-19 recovered patients are needlessly vaccinated. So in my view, these patients, it's contraindicated for them to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. No evidence of benefit and only evidence of harm.
Dr. Risch, even though Dr. Fauci has no grandkids of his own, I guess he wants yours to get vaccinated.
I'm not a grandparent yet, hopefully soon, but I'm not. But if I were, I would say that 6 and 4-year-olds would likely be able to get vaccinated by the time we reach the end of calendar year 2021, and at the latest into the first quarter of 2022.
And you would recommend it?
Oh, absolutely. If I had grandchildren, I would certainly recommend they get vaccinated.
Dr. Risch, how irresponsible is this?
Well, it's irrational, because young children particularly do not get very sick with COVID. They get fevers and headaches and tiredness, and that's it. They don't spread the virus. They certainly don't die from the virus. So neither they nor the society around them has any interest in vaccinating them. And the only thing that can happen to them is they get some harm from the virus. And now we've started to see in the VAERS database 15-year-old children getting heart attacks, 2-year-olds dying from a day after the vaccination, a 6-month-old dying from the child's mother's vaccination and getting it through breast milk. So children have no reason to die from vaccination. That isn't going to help them or the society either.
Well, Dr. McCullough, is this all about a constant stream of money that the drug companies make from the vaccines? I mean, now we're talking about booster shots. We heard Fauci talking about that today. So presumably the kids would have to get booster shots, I mean, forever, without any concern of natural immunity or acquired immunity after having been exposed.
Well, the vaccine stakeholders, the manufacturers, the NIH, the CDC, and the FDA, they made a great gamble. And the gamble was the epidemic was going to be closed out with vaccination alone. And what we found is the vaccine does not provide complete protection. And now we're seeing really alarming rates of harm in the adverse event reporting system. So the CDC really immediately needs to have an external, unbiased event adjudication committee and data safety monitoring committee, as it would in any clinical investigation.
Well, and the CDC Director Walensky, by the way, Dr. Risch, encouraging pregnant women, you referenced the breast milk issue, to get vaccinated. Watch.
We have no reason to suspect that these vaccines result in any infertility now or in the future. We have no reason to believe that getting vaccinated should change your menstrual cycle or make your periods any heavier. There have been decades and decades of research in mRNA technology that has led to the science that allowed us to meet this moment.
All right, Dr. Risch, setting aside the creepy music, what about this?
Well, the absence of information is not information on the absence of risk. And pregnant women have not been studied in the clinical trials of safety that were used by the manufacturers. And they haven't even been studied long enough to know what outcomes from first trimester vaccination. So that in the first third of pregnancy, if women get vaccinated, we don't even know what happens to their offspring. There's risks of stillbirth, of genetic abnormalities. We know that fevers in the first third of pregnancy increase risk of genetic abnormalities in the children, and these vaccines frequently cause fevers when they're given. So they have not been studied. There's the complete absence of information about what happens when you vaccinate pregnant women.
Anti-science. Doctors, thank you.
Well, you just heard from vaccine stakeholders, the CDC staffers, indicate that there's been decades of messenger RNA research. I can tell you that when the very first patient volunteered for injection with either Pfizer or Moderna, and they were a COVID recovered patient, a pregnant patient, a woman of childbearing potential, or even a child, that was the first time that these products were ever used in American medicine. The adenoviral vector by Johnson & Johnson is also novel technology. Both of these cause an uncontrolled production of the original Wuhan spike protein, the dangerous part of the virus, in the body, and it's now known that it circulates for 2 weeks. This damages blood vessels, organs such as the brain, the heart, the lungs, the kidney, the placenta, and the reproductive organs. And I can tell you as a doctor, I'm an internal medicine and cardiology specialist. About 70% of my patients were vaccinated early, December, January, February, before we had the safety data. But I can tell you at this point in time, in my view, the vaccine can no longer be considered safe. I base my opinions on the CDC Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, and through May 14th, 2021, with approximately 50% of Americans receiving at least one of the two doses of the vaccine or the single dose injection, there have been 227,805 safety reports. These reports are entered into a system that takes about 15 to 20 minutes per report. In each frame that's completed by the doctor or the patient has a warning that the submission is a falsification of a submission is subject to federal penalties, fines, and including imprisonment. So I can tell you these reports are very serious and they're solid and they're concerning. In America, after COVID-19 vaccination, most occurring on days 1, 2, and 3 after the vaccine, 4,201 deaths, 12,625 hospitalizations, 29,707 urgent care visits, 39,153 office visits, 1,070 cases of anaphylaxis or severe allergic reactions, 1,273 cases of Bell's palsy or a paralysis of half the face. In addition, there were numerous heart attacks, miscarriages, severe allergic reactions, and blood disorders reported. I can tell you as a doctor, there's never been a set of biologic products released on the U.S. market with this type of safety profile. Many have asked, well, how can doctors still recommend the COVID-19 vaccine? A lot of this has to do with difficulty in understanding the data and putting it in perspective. I have a recent analysis in from Dr. Andy Bostom, who is a former National Institutes of Health Framingham study epidemiologist, where he's compared rates that get entered into the safety system from the annual influenza vaccine compared to COVID-19 vaccine. So listen to these data. Individuals 18 to 49 years old. Now, these are people who I have not been recommending the COVID-19 vaccine at any time since they're so young, and COVID-19 would result in less than 1% chance of hospitalization and death. This is what's occurred. With the influenza vaccine annualized over 2016 to 2019, the overall numbers per million individuals who got the shot for a hospitalization was 2.0, and the number of deaths was 0.04. Those would be considered background rates, and we all accept that the influenza vaccine is safe and partially effective. I personally get it every year working as a doctor in a hospital and clinic. So those numbers were 2 for hospitalization and 0.04 for death per million individuals. For COVID-19 vaccination, the number for hospitalization was 49.6, and the number of for hospitalization was 4.2. This is very important. This basically means that the COVID-19 vaccine is 100 times more dangerous than the influenza vaccine, 100 times. And this is when it's given in a population that has less than a 1% risk of hospitalization and death with COVID-19. In my view, these statistics are unacceptable. Well, I've got a great show for you this week, but before I move on to introducing our guests, I do want to bring to your attention an important online meeting that's going to be held by the American Academy of Anti-Aging, and it's online June 5th through 6th, 2021. I'll provide the link. The website is a4m.com, a4m.com. And let's hear from the current society president, Dr. Heyman, about this important conference that's open to you.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Andrew Heyman. I'm the Academic Affairs Director for the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. And I really want to encourage all of you to attend our upcoming COVID-19 conference, a primer update from treatment to long haulers. As everybody knows, this is a really important subject. And even though the vaccine is out there, it's not going away anytime soon, especially with that whole new wave of COVID long haulers. So the topics that we're going to cover, first of all, we're inviting some of the best researchers and scientists on the subject. So this is a do not miss. They're going to review for us the epidemiology and at-risk populations related to COVID-19. We'll be covering current treatment guidelines for acute care of COVID-19, as well as anti-aging strategies as well. We'll also review lifestyle tools to improve metabolic flexibility and immunocompetency, and really currently synthesize the research on what do we know about the vaccines, their risks and benefits and side effects. There's a lot of debate about this. We're going to treat that topic in particular, I think, really well. And we'll also finish up looking at the pathophysiology, diagnosis, and potential treatments for that new COVID long hauler population that we're all really concerned about. So if you have any questions about the subject and you want to remain really up to date, I highly recommend that you attend our new COVID-19 primer. It's going to be an incredible couple days, and I think it'll answer a lot of your burning questions. So I hope to see you there.
So again, that's the American Academy of Anti-Aging online conference, June 5th through 6th. I will be one of the featured speakers at that conference, and the title is COVID-19, a primer update from treatment to long haulers. Well, I have a terrific lineup of speakers today, and I'm going to spend time with Dr. Scott Jensen, who is a family physician. He's a one-term state senator from Minnesota, and he's currently running for governor of Minnesota, and he's going to give his analysis on pediatric COVID-19 vaccination. This will be followed by a special interview with Dr. Avery Jackson, a renowned neurosurgeon in Michigan who's reoriented his medical response in his career to serve COVID-19 patients in Michigan and throughout the country. Uniquely, he has a wonderful online virtual learning center that he's going to introduce to the audience. And finally, I'll finish with Dr. Jack Lyons-Weiler, who's considered the world's expert in COVID-19 testing, and he'll navigate us through how COVID-19 is done through PCR, antigen, and sequencing, and how the over-testing and over-coding of COVID-19 has made things look a lot worse than what they really are with respect to new cases, hospitalizations, and death. Now, a word from our sponsor. Are you looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator of nutritional supplements for cell health. Most vitamins haven't been upgraded since the 1930s. Healthy Cell reinvented vitamins. Healthy Cell vitamins work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Absorb a healthier lifestyle with Healthy Cell's pill-free vitamins. Made with maximum absorption technology, Healthy Cell vitamins feed our bodies at the cellular level. Even if your vitamins aren't hard to swallow, it's time to upgrade to Healthy Cell's pill-free supplements. Our cells determine how well we feel, perform, and how long we live. That's the reason why I take Healthy Cell vitamins. The second is Immune Super Boost. Supporting our immune system while on the go can be simple with Healthy Cell's immune-boosting nutrients in one travel-ready gel pack. Combines over a dozen immune supplements into one travel-ready gel pack. So go to HealthyCell.com and use the promotional code OUTLOUD in all capital letters for a 20% off your first order of any Healthy Cell product. Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, you're listening to the McCullough Report.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health four times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report. I want to welcome to the show Dr. Scott Jensen. Dr. Jensen attended the University of Minnesota and got his undergraduate degree in physiology. He then went to dental school for a period of time at the University of Minnesota Dental School. He took a break and studied in a theological seminary and then went on to the University of Minnesota and received his MD degree. He went on to train in residency in family practice, and then was been a very productive clinician through a series of practices across Minnesota. His daughter has joined him in practice. He's recently retired. He served as a state senator for one term for Minnesota, and now he's currently running for governor of Minnesota. So let's welcome to the show Dr. Scott Jensen. Dr. Jensen, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. I appreciate it.
Well, your recent analysis of the benefits and risks of pediatric vaccination for the COVID-19 investigational vaccine really caught America's attention. Can you give us a quick summary of your analysis?
Essentially, a year and a half ago, 13 months ago, I cried foul when we were starting to see this changed environment in which COVID-19 was going to be diagnosed or whether it was going to be identified as the underlying cause of death on a death certificate. Then recently, three major papers, one in, I think, pediatric hospital came out and identified that the diagnostic criteria for stating that a certain number of pediatric hospitalizations were COVID-19 didn't stand up to an audit. And what had happened was 45% of the supposed COVID-19 admissions in the pediatric population were not COVID-19 admissions. They were admissions for chemotherapy. They might have been admissions for acute mental health crises or emergencies. in one situation, an acute appendicitis patient was identified as a COVID-19 patient, and they were admitted to have their appendix removed. Essentially, what triggered my analysis was this data is used to support the policies put in place. And some of these policies just don't make sense. It really gets to the point, Dr. McCullough, that it isn't just been one decision that's been made. It's literally been a series of decisions along the way. And it really argues for the sense of a culture being created whereby we want to ease and make it easy to diagnose COVID-19 as a cause of admission, diagnose COVID-19 as a discharge diagnosis, diagnose COVID-19 as a cause of death. This is truly a culture that's been created, and I think we need to get the word out. I have strong feelings about the danger of vaccinating children. If Moderna is going to use as an excluded population kids under the age of 16, why in the world are we doing that now? And why would we do it when we know that these kids have a far greater chance of dying of some other cause than of COVID-19?
Well, there's been analyses, one by Framingham expert epidemiologist, Dr. Andy Bostom, that estimates that there'll be much more harm in the pediatric population than there can ever be benefit. It's not even close. In fact, the benefit doesn't emerge for vaccination until over age 50. And now with the mounting safety cases of over 4,000 deaths reported to the CDC VAERS and over 12,000 hospitalizations, I think many internal medicine physicians, adult medicine physicians now are basically saying that it's over with. I can tell you in my practice, which is adults with internal medicine disease and heart, kidney, and lung disease, that about 70% of my patients have been vaccinated all December, January, February. But looking at the safety data now, I can no longer recommend it. Well, what do you think about the recent announcements from some states, I believe North Carolina, that's setting the precedent that children age 12 and above could decide on the vaccine at school without parents giving their consent?
In a word, I would say lunacy, absolute lunacy. This is so confounding for most thoughtful people. And I think what's going to happen is it's going to backfire, because I know there are people out there that have, if you will, bought into the COVID vaccine being the thing we have to do as adults. I get that. That's their viewpoint. But when you start to push on those parents and say, you don't even get to be the person making a choice for your 12 or 13-year-old, we're having young girls starting menarches, just starting their menstrual cycles, and they might walk out and get a vaccine, and they would get it, Dr. McCullough, for potentially the reason of not wanting to be inconvenienced in terms of being denied the opportunity to participate in extracurricular activities, summer sports camp. They're being told that if you do this, then your life will be easier, less complicated. You cannot ask a 12 or a 13-year-old to put all that together. Anybody who's studied any kind of psychology knows that you really don't start moving towards abstract thinking from concrete sequential thinking until you're about 13. These kids are not equipped to make that kind of a potential long-term decision that could affect their life. And another thing, I think that it's important for people to consider the NNV, the number needed to vaccinate in order to prevent one case, in order to prevent one hospitalization. If you look at Moderna and Pfizer, the number needed to vaccinate to prevent one case, not a death, not a hospitalization, is about 100. The number needed to vaccinate in terms of children to prevent one hospitalization is absolutely infinitesimally small. What we're doing is just immoral.
Well, I can tell you, I've managed hundreds of patients directly. I've advised on certainly over 1,000. About 85% of the time, the entire family is affected, or most family members are affected of the virus in the household, including the children. They do come through it remarkably quickly. I've had pediatric and young adults in my family have COVID-19. They've all come through terrific. They get wonderful immunity. The data suggests they actually act as a population immunologic buffer. Recent data suggests that their asymptomatic spread basically doesn't occur among children. Madewell and Cow have shown this in very large analyses. So we don't have to worry about the kids going to school and spreading it when they're asymptomatic. Parents just need to be prudent with respect to having a sick child and keeping them home. In my view, I do not see a role for vaccinating children. What I'm afraid of is that the promotion of vaccination for children is actually not for their benefit. It's actually thought to benefit others. And that violates a tenet of medical ethics. And the tenet is this, that we have a right to decide what goes into our body for our own benefit only. We would never inject something into a child's body and have that child take the risk for some theoretical benefit to others. It's never happened in human history. I'm deeply concerned as this moves forward. I can already see it right now. You're right. Parents and children are doing this in a sense because they want to travel. They want to participate in sports and school activities. Kids want to go to college this fall. They're doing it for those reasons. And based on the data, we will have fatalities. And those fatalities, the parents need to understand the fatalities will come. It is a mathematical reality. And so to lose a child for no benefit, in my view, is just unthinkable in today's society. Dr. Jensen, do you have any final words for our audience?
Dr. McCullough, I took an oath to first do no harm. I have a lot of grandparents and great-grandparents in their 80s and 90s who are just sick about the fact that their grandchildren or great-grandchildren might be forced to take a vaccine in order to presumably protect them. They don't want this. They want to make certain that we as a society are not doing any harm. And we are harming the kids. As you mentioned, there will be deaths. Statistically, there has to be. There will be hospitalizations from the vaccine. And we will not be able to decipher what level of collateral damage occurred to that physiology, to that immune system that might carry forward. I saw a recent article in the Journal of American Medical Association where we now know that IgA and IgG antibodies certainly cross over the breast milk. What does that mean for a newborn? Does that mean that this is a good thing that they have these antibodies circulating or not? People ask me, are you a conspiracy theorist? No, I'm not. But when I feel and sense this incredible push to give everybody a vaccine when it makes no medical sense, I think that there are people out there planting the seed for conspiracies, but it isn't me that's coming up with them.
You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to come up with the idea that maybe the vaccine isn't about COVID, because when things don't make sense, oftentimes they really don't make sense. It can't be about COVID. Well, I'll let that be the last word. Dr. Jensen, thank you for joining me on McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Today with me, I have a very special guest. I'm really honored to have him on the show, Dr. Avery Jackson. Dr. Jackson went to undergraduate at University of Chicago and then attended medical school at Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit. He went on and did his neurosurgery residency at Penn State University and then did a spine fellowship at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And he is in full neurosurgery practice in Grand Blanc, Michigan, and is an attending neurosurgeon at both Genesis Hospital and McLaren Hospitals in this part of Michigan, which is in a sense mid-Michigan. It's north of Southeast Michigan. And Dr. Jackson has really stepped up big in the COVID-19 pandemic, serving a great need, not only in the Michigan area, but also nationally. Dr. Jackson, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. Really appreciate you inviting me, Peter.
Well, tell the audience, how does a neurosurgeon kind of step out of your role as a neurosurgeon and really fill in a great need for outpatients suffering with COVID-19?
Yeah, and so just like anything else, you know, as docs, we care about people. And, you know, I started to see, you know, these neurologic complications of COVID-19 including vaccine issues and other issues, and said, this is crazy. I need to know more about this. This is going to affect me, my family, my patients. And I tell you, I said, I've got to know more about it. And so I reached out to you guys, the AAPS, and said, you know, you guys gave me some great information. And I said, I'm on board. I want to be able to help any way that I can, maybe help to organize or use a platform or help in any way that I can.
And you've helped us greatly with a platform called Echo. Can you tell the audience about Echo?
Yep. So Echo stands for Extension for Community Health Outcomes. It was founded by Dr. Sanjeev Arora in 2003 at University of New Mexico. He saw that there was a need in the community, especially where there's a lot of disparity in care, and said, how can we model what we do as physicians in terms of grand rounds or talking about cases to help support the primary care physician as well as the nurse practitioner or PA in the community? So he said, look, let's level set like a Zoom technology and grand rounds to have an organized way to disseminate knowledge very quickly. And so he uses the forced multiplier, actually, by saying, if I can get many primary care physicians and subspecialists together for an hour, we can have a program discussion and really disseminate knowledge quickly and ultimately help the underserved in our city, our nation, and in the countries.
I can tell the audience that I've personally attended an Echo event, and what Dr. Jackson has created is incredible through the computer, almost like virtual technology. It's like attending a symposium in a real auditorium. And he's brought some emerging legends in C19 care to the Echo Forum, including Dr. Stella Manuel, many others. And you have an upcoming special guest from a really dedicated physician who's cared for COVID-19 on American Indian reservations. And that's Dr. Lionel Lee. Can you tell us about that event?
Really excited. Actually, it's going to be next Tuesday, the 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And one other piece. So with Project Echo, we began that process and then created a separate platform, this virtual platform, and it's called Mogul. It's MNI Great Lakes Echo. So it's the Mogul platform. And we just hosted actually National Osteoporosis Foundation, had about 400 people on, and the event went really well.
Now, if we go past that in time, is there a way to go back and attend Echo kind of back in time past, like, say, the 25th, if we missed it?
Yep. So we'll have videos available, especially on the American Frontline Docs and other locations to access.
So one of the things that the pandemic has really created for us, in a sense, is forced our ability to work virtually. We're meeting virtually now. Our learning is much more intensified. And there's no greater need right now for doctors and nurse practitioners, as well as patients, to learn about early ambulatory treatment of COVID-19. Dr. Jackson and I not only manage patients primarily, but there's so many times we're called in as consultants. And at any given time, I am basically giving advice to dozens of practitioners across the country managing challenging patients. But it's so important for the audience to know that our work is resulting in dramatic reductions in hospitalizations. Yesterday, it was announced in Texas, we got to zero deaths for Texas in a day. And the only way to do that is to have markedly reduced hospitalizations. And the only way to do that is with early ambulatory treatment and hopefully have a good effect from other measures kicking in, including the vaccination program. Dr. Jackson, do you have any final words for our audience on the McCullough Report?
I'm just really impressed, Dr. McCullough, what you and the colleagues have done in your state. And our hope is with the Project Echo, we can disseminate exactly what you've done and replicate it so that we can have those numbers around the country and around the world.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jackson. It's been great to have you on the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
Each of us is born with 30 trillion cells that make us. These cells determine how we feel, perform, sleep, focus, and how long we live. And to live our best life, all we have to do is feed our cells. But most food and supplements don't reach our cells, keeping us from reaching our full potential. Make every cell count with Healthy Cell. Founded with a mission to empower people to take control of their own health at the most fundamental level, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, world-renowned cell researcher and medical doctor, created supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. And that's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
And it's my great pleasure to invite onto the show Dr. Jack Lyons Wilder. Dr. Lyons Wilder, received his bachelor's degree from the State University of New York at Oswego, and then went on to Ohio State University and received a master's degree, and then PhD from the University of Nevada. And after decades of research at major academic institutions, he launched his own research center, the Institute for Peer and Applied Knowledge. And he's been a leader in the COVID-19 response in helping epidemiologists and clinical scientists like myself understand the complexity of data coming in as we're all trying to interpret and react in the pandemic. And he has some very important insights for the general public to understand, as the general public over the last 14 months has had a flurry of epidemiologic numbers, almost a scoreboard up on the TV screen almost every night now. And so why don't we open it up? First off, Jack, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Oh, thank you, Peter. It's my pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's start from the very beginning. You know, about 14 months ago, Americans saw for the first time on any major news station in the upper right-hand corner, they started to see a scoreboard of COVID-19 cases and deaths. And give us an idea of where did that information come from, and how did the U.S. develop this this running tally?
Right. So early on, of course, there were no PCR tests. The symptom-based diagnosis was an estimator. As the PCR tests were brought on, early on, Deborah Birx of the White House decided to, well, she didn't decide, but it was the policy that she announced that every death that was test positive for COVID was going to be attributed to the virus. In other words, died with is going to be equal to died from. This happened in April of 2020. And of course, immediately I started hearing from colleagues who were very familiar with the process of death determination that there were going to be major problems with this. It's actually a consequence of the nature of the logic flow, the clinical logic flow for case determination. When a person presents with symptoms, if they're offered a test, they may be tested or not tested. And this is right now up until this day. They may be tested or not tested. And if they're tested, they may be test positive. That does not mean that they actually have COVID-19 by any means. The result could be a false positive. There are empirical estimates, peer-reviewed, published, independent estimates of the false positive rates, where scientists, including people in Australia and people in Connecticut here in the United States, decided to sequence the actual virus particles that were being amplified, and they could tell that up to 40% of the results may be false positive. The Australian result was 11%. And the problem really stems then to when patients are not tested based on clinical determination, other clinical determination, they may in fact then be given a COVID-19 diagnosis, or even if they're tested negative, they can be thrown back into the positive. In other words, the test result can be overruled by the clinician, And so this actual process leads to a conundrum. The conundrum, it turns out mathematically, the more you test, the higher the false positive rate. And it's been, no one has really addressed the following question. When does it become ethical when the prevalence of a virus such as coronavirus is low to switch from symptom-based testing? In other words, a person has to have presented with classic symptoms of coronavirus, which would be a dry cough, extreme pain while you're coughing, a fever, and from the core symptoms, loss of taste or sense of smell. When does it become ethical to switch from symptom testing people who are symptomatic or who have been in contact with known COVID cases, bona fide, verified COVID-19 cases, to indiscriminate testing, where a person can be tested because they feel like it, or a person can be tested because they suspect that they might have COVID, or screening for any purpose, such as, oh, we're going to test everybody on this particular college campus, et cetera. And so mathematically, I have a peer-reviewed analysis that shows that the percentage of the population that has to be infected on the same day is somewhere around 30% for the ethical switch for a virus that has this degree of transmissibility. The problem is when the prevalence is low, if you have any false positives at all, then the actual reality is that most of the test results are going to be false positives. And the reason why this was set up was out of an abundance of caution, because they could not produce a viable PCR test. CDC actually shipped a flawed test, and that allowed the virus to spread. And so we've really been behind since January, really, in terms of our ability to do any meaningful diagnostic testing. And that's why IPAC has joined a consortium by which independent scientists are going to obtain clinical samples from clinics, from doctors who recognize COVID-19 symptoms. And we will be sequencing these samples so that we can differentiate between samples that would otherwise be diagnosed as COVID-19, but might also be influenza A or B or respiratory syncytial virus or bacterial pneumonia. You know, we look at the death rates and the counts, the ticker in the corner of the screen on the television, and we see them mounting, the cumulative deaths. But one has to wonder how many of those deaths are due to misdiagnosis, and one also has to wonder how many of those deaths were preventable. The denial of early treatment is a very, very, very serious problem. There's overwhelming science that show that a number of early treatments can dramatically reduce the mortality rate of COVID-19. And those who said that this wasn't true initially were wrong. The science has shown now that ivermectin is extremely effective. The science has shown that hydroxychloroquine is somewhat effective if it's used early. And now there's a new study, a very exciting study, out of British Columbia, a phase 2 clinical trial of nitric oxide nasal spray that actually kills the virus in 95% of patients that have the infection within 24 hours. And that's going on to phase 3 trials in the UK. So hopefully we'll see the number of new cases and new deaths drop down. But in terms of diagnostics, this has been a mess. I was in the molecular pathology arm of the Department of Pathology at the University of Pittsburgh. And I spent my time in the cancer center optimizing biomarkers for early detection of cancer with the National Cancer Institute. So there's nothing being done that I know of anywhere to upgrade the diagnostic or differential diagnosis of respiratory illnesses. And that's why we have set upon this independently funded, 100% by the public, to do the science that we do. And we're going to start sequencing as soon as we have sufficient funding for the project to get off the ground.
Well, it sounds like very important work for our listeners who are out there, though, just the general public. Can you explain the difference between PCR antigen testing and sequencing?
Sure. So a PCR test uses what are called primers. These are 18 to 21 nucleotide sequences, that match mirror actually, they're complementary to whatever target sequence you're trying to detect. And through a series of cycles of temperature in the presence of an enzyme called polymerase and in the presence of nucleotides, then in a vial, we can do PCR to amplify or reproduce and multiply in an exponential fashion the number of copies of the target. The problem is that any primers that can be designed will eventually amplify whatever DNA sequence it is presented to. And the inexactness of the test, especially in terms of the false positives, is greatly amplified by using I found it very strange that they use a universal cycle threshold for case determination. Those cycle thresholds were very high. So every time you run through the phases of the temperature, that's a cycle. And there's an optimal cycle for sure, but really what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to have a positive control and a negative control in every analysis, and then you take the difference between your negative control and your patient sample to see. Instead, what they've done is they said, well, we're going to push the cycle threshold, and we don't have to reach the exponential point in the reaction until we've gone through 40 cycles. Well, if you can do that to a carrot or a pineapple, and you can have COVID-19 on the, you know, and it's the World Health Organization admitted this in February. And so this is the CDC just actually recently published an article, a guidance for the so-called breakthrough infections of COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2 infections in people who are vaccinated. And they have a lower cycle threshold if you're vaccinated than if you're not vaccinated. So it appears that it is a policy decision that is based on the fear that you might miss a case. But what's the cost of all the lockdowns? What's the cost of the interminable quarantining? You know, the businesses, hundreds of thousands of businesses have been permanently shuttered. The suicide death rate is through the roof. We've lost, I don't know, billions of dollars, trillions globally in terms of lost economics, so lost jobs and so on. So we really have to take a look at both sides of the equation. And the way that I view this is that public health has forced allopathic medicine to externalize the cost of the false positive. So if people want to know more about this, they can find the peer-reviewed publication. I have a blog, it's called jameslyonsweiler.com. But if you look up my name, and if you look up the cost of the false positives, or if you do look on Twitter and you go to hashtag cost of the false positive, you'll see that I've been at this from the beginning. It's really clear. There's no reason why we can't use sequence-based diagnosis. I mean, it's absolutely important. And certainly nucleic acid diagnosis should be done specifically as a confirmatory step, not as a screening step. And then we have the antigen-based tests, and there's two types. The IgG test allows us to detect antibodies that the body's produced in response to the virus. And that's when the virus has been around a while, that's probably cleared from the body. And an IgM test, which actually tells you if you're producing new antibodies and the body's actively fighting off an infection of some kind. And so between nucleic acid and, you know, these antigen tests, the CDC was originally double counting cases that had reports from both tests. There were excess numbers of test results from Oklahoma, for instance. There was some 2,500 discrepancy on what the state said that they reported. So it's been a mess. And we really can do much, much better. Now, the benefit of sequencing and actually determining the nucleotide sequence of what you've amplified is that we could determine if it's coronavirus or if it's some other pathogen. So the people who have bacterial pneumonia would know that they have bacterial pneumonia, not just go home and wait for 10 days to see if they have, if they develop the need for emergency care. That's what our elderly are being told when they test positive: go home and do nothing and wait to see if you get sick enough to go to the emergency room. That's unethical. That's malfeasance. That has to stop. Treatments are coming. It's inevitable. And the people who believe that they are protected from coronavirus infection due to the vaccination really have to understand what this virus is capable of doing. This virus is mutating, it's changing, and it's escaping the test due to mutations in the primer sites. 8.5% of the mutations that are in known variants mapped to these very tiny primer sites are 18 to 20 MERS. Compared to the rest of the genome, 29,000 bases. So we really should be seeing an even distribution of mutations. Instead, you know, the UK variant is a test escapee. It's known. This is known. It's not like this. I'm not making this up. And so the spike protein being in the vaccine itself is a target, a three-way target of our immune system, of the vaccine immunity, and of the test. And so that's going to be the most rapidly evolving part of this virus. And so it seems to be 100% clear to me that not only are we going to need boosters, but anybody that gets infected with a spike protein that's different than the one they were infected against is the sitting duck for this virus.
Well, you know, it seems to me, since a positive test is consequential, meaning that somebody has to leave work, they have to be quarantined. You know, it could be the initial notice of a fatal course. It seems like a positive test is so consequential that we would get into exactly what we did with HIV, is we get into confirmatory testing. So if we were positive on PCR, we could confirm it with potentially a sandwich assay for the nucleocapsid, the so-called rapid antigen test, or we could do sequencing. Not the whole thing. Maybe just the Chinese have done studies where they just try to sequence some of the nucleocapsid. We just want to tell the person that indeed the virus is truly there.
Yeah, that's important. Is the virus is truly there or not? The virus being there also does not mean that the virus is causing disease, as you know. Our approach in the consortium is twofold. We're going to be sequencing target sequences that are independent of the spike to make sure. We're going to sequence through the primer sites to make sure that if there's a variant that has silenced one of our primers, that we can pick that up. And that's called nested primers. No problem. This is classical molecular diagnostic technique. It's nothing new. And we're going to also do next-gen sequencing so that we can actually try a new approach to differential diagnosis, not just of coronavirus, but of influenza and RSV, and by doing shotgun sequencing to determine what percentage of the reads that are generated through next-gen sequencing following amplification and, you know, the reverse transcription and amplification actually map to known pathogen.
Okay, Jack, I want to finish with...
This is going to be the future of molecular diagnosis.
Oh, I completely agree. And we, you know, our in vitro diagnostics community did respond. We had this initial flurry of activity. What I haven't seen is the sophistication layered on over 12 months. It doesn't seem like our public health officials had the expertise to do the types of things you've mentioned. Let me, I want to finish with a mathematical problem just to give our viewers, our listeners, an idea. We have 1,000 individuals in two different settings. One of them is an urgent care, and 1,000 people go to the urgent care because they have fever, nasal congestion, URI symptoms, and they think they have COVID. Okay, that's one group. Now we have 1,000 kids on a college campus who have no symptoms, and they're just forced to go through screening in a dormitory. In the urgent care center, let's say that 50 cases in a day turn positive, that they do 1,000 tests, but 50 are positive in the urgent care. In the college, they do 1,000 tests, and let's say 10 come back positive. Tell the listeners, in the urgent care, 50 cases identified. In the dorm, 10 cases, 10 positives. Tell them the true positive numbers in each one, your best estimate.
Okay, so the best estimate of the positive cases in the, well, we have to be concerned about the technical errors that can occur in the testing.
Right.
So if there are 10 positive cases on the campus, it could be maybe there are six that are test positive. However, the viremia in those people, because they're young and their innate immune system is kicking this virus's butt, we may have one person that could transmit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. And so that's the difference. There's clinical differences in the presentation, as you well know. In urgent care, what you've done is you've enriched the population, not only for the the people that are going to be positive, but of the 50 people, mm-hmm. if you take the 40% false positive, this false positive rate that I think is probably correct, it's a maximum, right? It could be as high as 20 people. Or don't have the virus. So you might have 30 people, but they might have bacterial pneumonia, or they might have mm-hmm. RSV, or they might have influenza, they might have influenza B. So there's 20 people that will be given the instruction to, sorry, there's nothing we can do for you, go home. Mm-hmm. And the person could be on their way to dying from bacterial pneumonia without any attendant care whatsoever. So if there are 30 people that are positive, then if it's representative of the entire age distribution, then, 30 that are positive, you probably have 10 or 15 of them might be, capable of transmitting. So then of those people that are capable of transmitting, that's reasonably high out of 50 people that are there for the same reason. But all of them are sent home without any care. They're not told, and they're not given any of the scientific information that's been published on how to reduce mm-hmm. their own viremia through treatment. Mm-hmm. And so if they went home and reduced their viremia through treatment, they would not die, most likely. They would not transmit to others. And so treatment should be seen as an adjuvant to your vaccination program, if anything. The ability to bring down viremia doesn't just save lives. It actually reduces viremia, so the person can no longer transmit. And that's critically important if we're going to get back to normal. There's no way that the vaccination program is going to lead to herd immunity. We've done the math on that. That's not going to happen.
Well, I'll let that be the last word. Students, class is over. You've been listening to Dr. Jack Lyons-Waller, who is one of the leaders in understanding COVID-19 testing, the pandemic, and the implications. Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. You're listening to the McCullough Report.